Peters, Mr. Cade. We'll go on to the third case of the day. United States versus Van Weyenberg, and that's appeal number 053370. Good morning, Mr. Hildebrand. Come on up.
I'm court-appointed counsel for Mr. Van Weyenberg.
And of course, you have the court's thanks for taking this appeal.
Well, these cases are always interesting and a challenge. Before I begin my argument, I cited a case called U.S. versus Olcay on page 55 of my brief, and it's discussed around there. In July, the Eighth Circuit vacated the decision, and I'll give you the cite. It's 454 F. 3rd, 848. That case was cited for the proposition that the Due Process Clause requires that sentence enhancements be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And the court may wish to look at the Eighth Circuit opinion. We continue to maintain, though, that based on these other cases, that that sentence enhancements should be subject to the burden of proof of beyond a reasonable doubt, because they really determine what the sentence is, even though we're under a basically discretionary guideline application. But because this court, and I'm certainly not criticizing it, has the presumption of reasonableness for sentences within the guidelines, when the guideline determination is made, it's very difficult to argue that there's something unreasonable about this, about the sentence imposed based upon case law in this circuit. So it is a matter of great importance. I would like to spend a few minutes. The government's appendix contained the motion to terminate counsel and appoint new counsel. And one of the things that the government did in its brief is it argued that Mr. Van Weyenberg's motion asked for things that were obviously not available. But in his motion, it's pretty apparent that Mr. Van Weyenberg was very concerned that his lawyer had not contacted his former lawyer, and that he had to go into this SEC consent decree basically without representation.
Well, of course, you know, there is no absolute, there's no right to counsel in a civil proceeding.
Oh, I understand that, Your Honor, but when you're faced with a criminal proceeding and you have had a former lawyer who has been advising you all along, what should your defense counsel be doing? And he was complaining to the court that witnesses hadn't been interviewed and that this particular lawyer...
What consideration did he get from the SEC in exchange for his waiver of his double jeopardy claims?
I don't know. I don't know of any. I think, let me respond. First of all, I don't think he waived his double jeopardy claims, except insofar as there were various things imposed by the SEC. There were cumulative things such as disgorgement, an injunction, and a civil penalty, among others. And I think that the language of the agreement, which is in our appendix, should be read to say that, okay, he's waiving double jeopardy with respect to multiple punishment aspects set forth in the in that agreement itself.
But why would there be any need to waive a claim of double jeopardy based on a single civil proceeding?
Well, our position is that it wasn't waived. And the government argues in its brief that it was waived based on this language. And we think the Morgan and the Hudson cases, which we cited in our brief, are fairly clear that there was no waiver.
Well, the government also argues that this isn't a double jeopardy situation, period, irrespective of waiver.
I understand that, Your Honor, but one of the problems here is that the district court, I mean, whether it was or wasn't depends on kind of a what I would say is a mixed fact, mixed legal conclusion. You look at what happened and you make these conclusions based on the test set forth in, by the Supreme Court in the other Hudson case, which we discussed. But the district court did not make any of these determinations. Instead, it talked about the Tankersley case, which is clearly distinguishable because it not only involves different statutes, but no civil fine or civil forfeiture penalty was imposed in Tankersley. So when a double jeopardy claim is presented, I think the district court has the responsibility to review that, and then, of course, the defendant has the right to appeal that before trial. And the complaint here is that there's two complaints. Number one, it was not waived, and secondly, the district court should have dealt with it. The counsel argument is based on a conflict of interest. It's our position that once Mr. Van Weyenburg raised all of these issues, and he continued to raise them in the midst of the trial, he raised it again, is that the attorney had a personal conflict between him and the client because the client felt with some reason that the attorney wasn't doing what he was supposed to do in representing him. And that's why, for example, if there's a question about the adequacy of trial counsel, that you should have a different appellate counsel, because otherwise the appellate counsel is saying, well, what I did at the trial was okay. And here again, the court did not conduct any hearings on this, and we think the court should have.
Well, but his pro se filings clearly explained what he thought his attorney's failings were, and even if, and I certainly am not saying there was, but even if there was any error on the district court's part, it would be harmless, because it surely appears that his counsel provided effective assistance at the trial and after the trial. And I mean, he never alleged a total breakdown of communication.
Well, to answer that question, this is, I think Your Honor is using the Strickland standard. And when by asking that question, I interpret it as you're asking me about the Strickland. But I think that when you have a situation involving conflicts or potential conflicts, that is not the standard. Rather, the standard is set forth in the Pergler case, which we have cited in our brief. And that makes it very clear and I'll quote from it, when it's here, the claim is based on a conflict of interest. The defendant can satisfy the prejudice element by proving that either his counsel labored under an actual conflict or was subject to a potential conflict that was called to the attention of the court. Now, it struck me in reviewing this record, usually when I accept appointments, you see that motions have been made, instructions have been requested, et cetera, and the trial court denies the motion or grants the government's motion. So then you have something you can appeal on. The only motion I saw that was made and denied was giving him access to the library at the South Bend Jail. But I'm not here to either criticize or praise the way this case was defended. All I'm saying is that the trial judge obviously felt that trial counsel was extremely well qualified. He was death penalty certified. But when you look at the record as a whole, I'm not so sure that all that was done was what could have been done here. But again, the effective assistance of counsel question, I'm sure my client intends to file a 2255 motion if he's unsuccessful in this appeal. But I do think there should have been hearings, and I also believe that he didn't waive his rights. And the other issues, I think, have been very well covered in the briefs, not only filed by us, but the government. So thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. Thank you. Ms. Brooke?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would just like to advise the panel that I was the trial attorney in this case and have lived with this case for many years and would be happy to clarify any issues that the court may have.
Well, what did he get from the SEC in consideration for his agreement to waive any claim of double jeopardy?
Your Honor, I was not involved in the SEC case, probably to avoid 600 people coming into court and trying to lynch him would be one benefit that he avoided. And I'm being sarcastic. I was not involved in that case. The double jeopardy issue is a non-starter. The Morgan case, the Hudson case, the whole issue there is there was never the words mentioned double jeopardy. Why would double jeopardy even be an issue if there wasn't something subsequent that's going to happen to it? So in terms of the waiver, whether you deal with the waiver or you don't, de novo review. The Palmisano case is right on all fours. It's looked at these penalties. These penalties are not disproportionate, and therefore the double jeopardy claim would have failed regardless.
You know, you could help me with this. If his criminal conviction should remain intact, so does the SEC decree, he has two obligations to repay over $20 million. The $24.5 million disgorgement order by the SEC and the $20.9 million restitution order entered by the district court. If both of those figures represent the loss amount, isn't there a problem with requiring him to pay twice?
And I believe Palmisano, I believe that's the case that addressed that. Obviously, no. The victims will not recover twice, as much as they probably would like to. They will not recover twice.
They probably
whatever.
Won't recover once.
Yeah.
They probably won't recover once.
Unfortunately, the receiver has made a disbursement. Matter of fact, right before trial, the victims got 16 cents on the dollar so far. But so the double jeopardy issue, obviously the government's position is there was no double jeopardy concerns, whether he waived it or he didn't waive it, de novo review. The Palmisano case clearly went into the penalty sections of the Remedial Act, and there is no double jeopardy concerns.
I wanted to just talk about the enhancement for a moment. The enhancement for more than 600 victims, isn't that contingent on his having used mass mailings?
Not necessarily. I think they do address two different harms. The fact that Mr. Van Weyenberg was able to disseminate these materials from coast to coast still may not have given rise to maybe 40 people or 30 people. The more than 600 victims represents the victim side. How many people were impacted by these promises that were not fulfilled versus Gary Van Weyenberg's approach, his methodology in disseminating this information. So I do think that they are distinct harms that can be recognized. Obviously, the Sentencing Commission back in 1987 when they came into effect, and I have been around since the guidelines have been in effect. I've been with the office a long time. And courts, as this circuit has, gives great deference to the work that has gone into the guideline amendments over the years, and these are distinct harms and if that are met versus if we just go purely under 3553A, you're aggravating factors. I mean, basically the Sentencing Commission took aggravating factors and assessed them points. So in terms of the overlapping enhancements, again, post-Booker, it's a different world now. The court and Judge Sharp truly in this case did it right. He looked at the factors, he calculated the guidelines, and he certainly could have done whatever he did under the guidelines post-Booker as long as he was able to explain it to this court. But in this case, he gave the low end of the range, obviously contrary to what the government wanted, which was the high end of the range. So this is a reasonable sentence. Mr. Van Weyenberg has not rebutted that presumption. And the sentence should stand, the conviction should stand. And let me just remark a bit about his filings with the court. The only way that he would have gotten a hearing, and that's what this circuit has said, is if it isn't clear to the judge what it is the defendant is complaining about. Well, given his pro se filings, single-spaced, six pages, there was no doubt that this was a conflict in trial strategy. This court has held that that is not enough to substitute counsel. And he continued to write during the course of the trial the same complaints. And the government's position is what he was complaining about were issues that would have gone nowhere anyways. So obviously, we will be dealing with these issues down the road. And I do want to mention, though, by raising the conflict of interest, and I understand the footnotes that Mr. Hildebrand has put in there, it's very difficult to deal with effective assistance of counsel and not deal with effective assistance of counsel. So I believe Judge Sharp dealt with the issue. He dealt with it straightforward. That's exactly what Mr. Van Weyenberg was complaining about. He found counsel to be competent. He certainly got his Sixth Amendment right to counsel, and the decision by the court, by the jury, and the sentence imposed should be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Brooke. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, I think all you need to do is look at the filings that are in the government's appendix, and you will see that there's a lot more going on here than a conflict in trial strategy. Our point is that not that we are arguing for ineffective assistance of counsel, but our point is that in accordance with the precedent which we cited in our brief, that the court should have had a hearing on this and not merely said, well, this is a defendant who's trying to get a delay in his trial. And that is the position. I don't think we're trying to, you know, fool anybody or skate between a rock and a hard place or anything like that. Our position is that there should have been a hearing, and it was an error for the court not to provide a hearing in accordance with the precedent that we have. Addressing your question, Judge Rovner, about the enhancements, it's pretty clear that the cumulative effect of all these guidelines was a pretty high count on the grid, so to speak. And we cited a Second Circuit case where a similar thing happened, and the Second Circuit held that that when you have such a situation, perhaps a downward departure should be considered. And I don't know exactly what Judge Sharp did, but perhaps he was influenced by the cumulative effect of all of this by giving him a sentence at the low end of the guideline. But this court has also held in a number of cases that even though sentences within the guidelines are presumed reasonable, there may be instances where they are not reasonable. And it is our contention that the cumulative effect of all these enhancements is such that the sentence is unreasonable.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Hildebrand. Again, thank you. You have the thanks of the court for taking on this task. And thanks to Ms. Brooke for her, as always, fine presentation. Okay, we're going.